You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 4th of May 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, thousands more migrants rescued from the Mediterranean over the weekend.
We all know very well that the flow of refugees and migrants go through Libya, a place where there is not a state entity able to control territory and borders.
EU Foreign Policy Chief Federica Mogherini is among those searching for a solution, but is there one? Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott thinks so.
What the Australian people elected us to do was to stop the boats, and if we stop the boats, we stop the deaths.
I'll be discussing whether or not it's really that simple with studio guests Samira Shackle and Alessio Patilano. We'll also look at the day's other top stories, including Saudi Arabia's denial of ground forces in Yemen, the wisdom or otherwise of selling citizenship, and the strategic consequences of environmental degradation in the Arctic. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, right now. And welcome to Midori House live on Monocle 24 from Studio One here in London. My guests today are the journalist Samira Shackle and lecturer in war studies at King's College, Alessio Patilano. Welcome both back to Midori House. Now, despite the hideous risks of the Mediterranean crossing, the boats keep on coming. This past weekend, according to the Italian Coast Guard, more than 6,800 migrants have been rescued. 10 bodies have also been recovered, adding to a toll of at least 1,750 people who have drowned fleeing Africa for Europe this year alone, a 20-fold increase on the same period in 2014. Samira, I'll ask you first, rescuing them, and I mean this in no way to undersell the difficulty and risks in such an operation, it's actually kind of the easy bit. Are we any closer, do you think, to a satisfactory answer about what to do with these people once they arrive in Europe?
No, I don't think we are. And I think that's a really big problem. And I'd agree with you, actually, that, you know, the search and rescue operations are obviously hugely important. And you can see that just by the sheer volume of people being saved and by the sheer volume of people who died to prompt this action at all. But I think it's very telling that Britain's promised Navy ship isn't being deployed because they don't want to let it out until they can be sure that they're not going to have to offer asylum to anyone who they take on the Navy ship, and that they can let people off at Italy, which is technically the closest port and therefore under international law the place where they should claim asylum. But I think this is the thing, really. You've got over the course of the last couple of years, EU member state leaders sort of ignoring the problem a bit. Now the death toll is so high that they can't really ignore the problem. And yet you have people now sort of focusing in on this thing, okay, well, we're going to stop people dying at sea, but not thinking at all about what they're going to do once they get here, and sort of shoving them on an island off Italy isn't really an answer.
Alessio, is there a satisfactory answer as to, once these people have been rescued, and I think, you know, only a total psychopath would argue that there isn't, you know, that rescuing them isn't the right thing to do. Of course, that's what you should do. The tricky bit is, of course, once they arrive in Europe, morally and or legally, what do or what does the European Union or indeed the wealthy world in general actually owe them?
Well, that's a very good question. I think it's the real question that the Europeans haven't really tackled. I dare say that actually that is the reason why the problem hasn't been addressed at very heart, because the question is not, as has always been the case, the question is not whether you rescue people or not, because there should be no doubt as to, if you've got people in distress at sea, the risk of lives, you should go and try to get them out. And the problem is what happens afterwards. And I think it's kind of ridiculous, to be honest, the whole argument that the British government at the moment is like, oh, by the way, sorry, let's make sure that they stay in Italy, because we can't really take them on here. You know, that is borderline.
Well, the week before an election, you are not going to get a British government saying, yeah, they're totally welcome here.
Yeah, or in any other week.
In any other week, but especially not this week.
Let's put it this way. And the question is, why isn't anybody else? Because we know from Italian statistical data that a very large portion of migrants don't stay in Italy. As soon as they clear from health and a document point of view, they try try to move on. They try to go to Germany, Belgium, France, the Netherlands. Not that many actually try to cross the channel. So the question is, where are all the other Europeans? And the question is, well, I don't see them anywhere in sight with any type of solution. Because the problem is, either you tackle European immigration policy, or you tackle the problem at the source. That is, why these people are making the cross in the first place. And I don't think there is anyone in Europe at the moment that actually is willing to engage without the question.
Well, we'll come back to that question shortly. Samira, I did want to pick up on that point you raised when I suggested that the British government was likely to be unwelcoming this week, and you said, or indeed in any week. But that's completely true. But it's also part of the problem in that with the best will in the world, whatever the actual leaders of EU nations may think and may want to do and may think is the right thing to do, is the problem not that realistically they know very, very well that their constituencies, the actual people of Europe, don't really feel all that much sympathy for these people?
Yeah, I think that's been sort of persistently the difficulty in enacting any kind of humane asylum policy, is that populations in developed countries are often quite anti-asylum, basically. And so I think it's self-perpetuating. It's not just a case of, okay, politicians are listening to the public and therefore they shouldn't do anything to help them. It's also the fact that we have an increasingly anti-immigrant rhetoric. You have politicians over the course of at least one decade, if not two, if not more, conflating, certainly on Tony Blair's government, willfully conflating economic migrants and asylum seekers. So there isn't that proper distinction being drawn.
Although we don't know what proportions of the people on the boats are economic migrants and asylum seekers. I suspect there's both.
I'm sure that's true, but whatever they are, they're very desperate people. And I don't think that, I mean, the other thing is that while it may be politically unpopular, it's happening and it's real people and people are continuing to make the crossings and something needs to be done, whether that's an interim solution. But, you know, it's not necessarily like you have to hand out passports at the borders. I think you can. There are all sorts of humane solutions. You can give people temporary status over a few years. You could have some kind of continent-wide policy where people are sort of agreeing to certain numbers of resettlement, as you had with, for instance, Germany agreeing to take on Syrian refugees. So you can have specific programs with specific countries. You can sort of take steps, I think, to alleviate the pressure, the situation where you just have people either drowning in the Mediterranean or sort of landing on the shores of Greece and Italy and getting stuck in detention centres.
I was thinking about it, and this, what I'm about to say probably connects also to what the Australians were saying and why I think that their solution is not really sort of possible in Europe.
Well, the Australian solution, we should just emphasise, has been, for better or worse, to try and remove from the equation the incentive by making it clear that there is no path to residency in Australia if you arrive illegally.
True. At the same time, if you look at the statistics of the past 2 years, in the last 2 years, and we're talking about just the people that were rescued, not the people that were actually making the crossing, we're talking about something in the region of a little short of 200,000 people, right? Now, 200,000 people, just to give you sort of a bit of a context, if you take, for example, Italy, where most of 160,000 were the only ones that were saved in between last year and the beginning of this year by the Italian Navy and the Italian Coast Guard, only this number is larger than your average medium-sized city in Italy.
Yeah.
So we're talking about a very large number of people. And that is part of the problem, because the detention centres are full and they cannot handle that many more. And any type of other sort of solution that we have is always thought out for small contingents, small cases, most of the time individual
and
cases.
The Australian example is dealing in relatively smaller numbers.
Absolutely.
Australia also has the advantage, I can't think of a way it could be incorporated in Europe, in that Australia has essentially bribed a few other countries to be bases for these people, and I can't see anywhere in the Mediterranean there is a plausibly stable country that you could.
Well, interestingly enough, this was the case before Gaddafi was taken out. This was, you know, one of the reasons, or one of the hidden reasons behind Berlusconi's big opening to Gaddafi a few years back, was precisely to pay off. In fact, the Berlusconi government went that far to actually provide the custom the custom control training, so the Navy component of our border forces, were training the Libyan Coast Guard, which in a way was another way to try to help the Libyans not have people leaving from their shores coming towards Italy. So they were trying to, in one way, to bribe the local government with incentives, economic infrastructural projects and that sort of thing. On the other, capacity building, all together to limit that. At the moment, I don't think that isn't a solution. And that wasn't a solution either. I mean, it was a solution in the sense that you could find a willing party to come to play. But really, it doesn't address what Samira was saying earlier on, which is the fundamental problem. We've got lots of people that are in desperate condition and are trying to make a crossing. So either we're trying to make their life better so that they don't feel like they have to cross. And again, I'm not so sure how far we are from that.
Well, we're talking about people largely from Eritrea, Somalia, Syria and Nigeria. Making all those countries pleasant, peaceful, prosperous places,
it's not going to happen next week. Exactly right. So the question is really whether one should have a healthy conversation about how to deal with all the issues that we've been talking about in context of EU migration policies, and perhaps also rethink some better ways to actually allow for a different type of asylum seekers in larger sort of numbers to be welcomed in Europe, not isolate them. Because at the moment, what is happening is that, you know, if you go to places like Lampedusa or some of the smaller islands where you have the detention center, I mean, it's terrible because these are isolated and the locals hate them because they see them as a potential threat. And the moment they get out, they start spreading around. The only thing you have is like local media reporting about how badly these people behave. So it sort of builds up a tremendous divide. And rather than promoting integration or empathy, if not sympathy, it creates division and even more hostility towards them. So at the moment, we're really in the bad place.
Samira, I guess a final thought on this before we move on to a couple of more or less related stories. You were talking about maybe an idea by which the burden was spread around Europe, where Europe actually had a serious conversation about how to accommodate more people. The hideous end of the moral knot there, though, is that if you enlarge the possibility for resettlement in Europe, do you then not just encourage more boats, which means more people die?
I'm not really convinced of that. That's an argument that comes up a lot. I see what you're saying in this particular instance, but I think it comes up a lot. It's certainly come up a lot in this country when talking about illegal migrants, whatever, asylum seekers. And it came up about this, about the search and rescue operations. There's this idea that if you make it easier, then it will make more people come, and it's a pull factor. But actually, I think quite consistently, statistical analysis has shown that it's push factors that make people come. It's conflict, it's poverty, it's those factors. Someone sort of in a desert in Somalia probably isn't like, oh, I hear they've got a really good scheme, so maybe I'll just go and spend sort of 4 months trekking across the continent and risking my life across the boat. It is generally a genuine need that pushes people, and I think that's what kind of statistical studies have shown over the years, is that is a much bigger cause. So while I think it's, you know, fine to consider that, I think that it's highly unlikely, given the climate across the EU and across different member states, it's highly unlikely that it would be a sort of lax open door, everyone's welcome policy. I think it would probably still include quite rigorous constraints and checks and measures on each case, as it does at the moment in member states. So whatever form that took of some sort of spreading the burden, temporary resettlement, whatever it is, I think it would be something that would be subject to very strict checks.
Okay, well, we were mentioning Australia and its attitude to immigrants there a second ago, which brings us to our next topic, because Australia has been famously unkeen on undocumented poor people in boats, but one think tank at least has suggested a rather more hospitable approach to rich people, even to the extent of selling them passports. The government's independent wonk shop, the Productivity Commission, has suggested selling the right to immigrate to Australia, which may or may not happen. It is at the moment just an idea. But I guess the question is, should it? Alessio, first of all, this does, speaking as an Australian myself, rather have the whiff of Banana Republic about it. Is it really? Is this getting a bit weird?
Sorry, would you be offended if I were to say that actually it is looking a little bit weird?
Not even slightly. Do carry on.
Fine. Because, you know, it's like if you read the two stories on the back of each other, you know, the one about, you know, look at our model about, you know, how we're dealing with immigrants. I was like, right, go on. Yes. What is the side that I don't know of that you think is brilliant? And then you see about, oh, by the way, we come up with a better plan. We're going to start selling Australian passports. I'm not sure where this leads. I suppose that there's two things to say. First of all, that the geographic conditions in Australia are very different in the sense that...
We're a big island in the middle of nowhere.
Yes, yeah. So there's that. And also, I think it kind of, for me, what really is really odd is the fact that Australia was built out of this very international, diverse social fabric.
And indeed it still is. This is the contradiction about Australia that always baffles me.
Exactly.
It's obviously an immigrant country. It is largely, I think, a very successful, equable and functional immigrant
Absolutely.
Country. And yet we do still seem to have this extremely weird attitude to the prospect of the next generations of Australians.
Right. So part of that is explained in an attitude that goes back about 2001 elections in France, whereby the Front National, which this was the last time the Front National was really sort of risking of taking power, yeah, when there was Chirac and Le Pen facing each other. It was quite interesting that if you went down to the south eastern part of France, so Marseille and all the sort of rear guard of there, the people that were voting Front National were all first generation immigrants. So there, and he had a clearly anti-immigration policy. So that is explained perhaps from the perspective of those who were there and don't want to see sort of their children deprived of opportunities.
It's the pull up the ladder jack tendency. Samira, the idea, and again, we should suggest, reiterate that this is an idea by a think tank, and it does sound like somebody has been eating a lot of cheese and then reading far too much Ayn Rand before bed. But their idea is to use entry fees as actually a primary determinant as opposed to skill shortage, almost auctioning it off. But there are countries which do sell citizenship. Cyprus does, Grenada, Antigua, Malta, St. Kitts. Is it necessarily a bad idea? I mean, even this country and the United States offer residency to rich people.
I think it's quite a bad idea. I mean, from the perspective of the Australian government, as you've both been saying, it's pretty inconsistent, given that you've got, on the one hand, Tony Abbott quite proudly trumpeting the fact that they just sort of send back all migrant boats and never give asylum under any circumstances, and then on the other hand, so it's this proposal to just sell off citizenship, which would mean losing control of who can access it. I mean, I suppose it's sort of slightly self-limiting would be the argument, but it still sort of gives the potential for the government to lose control of that aspect of immigration. But I think generally there is something very distasteful about the idea of selling off citizenship, and I think it just very starkly sets out that inconsistent attitude to different people, and sort of is the idea. I think what sits so sort of nastily about it is the idea that that rich people are just better than poor people. It's not very nice, is it? And it's I think you see it to a certain extent all over the place, as you say. I mean, the sort of recent UK policy about spousal visas are only available if you've got a certain level of income, which means that people who are married but don't earn over I can't remember exactly what the number is, but over a certain amount just can't get a visa for their husband or wife. And, you know, that's also a pretty nasty state of affairs. And I think it's just sort of taking that to more further and further extremes.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, along with my guests, Samira Shackle and Alessia Patilano. Coming up, Saudi Arabia says it has or possibly hasn't deployed troops on the ground in Yemen. We'll be trying to figure out if they have and if that would be really such a bad idea. Do stay tuned.
Global affairs, culture, business, design or urbanism, at Monocle 24 we've got it covered. And when it comes to transport and travel, you need look no further. From automobile innovators to the creative minds shaping the in-flight experience, we speak to the experts to ensure you have all the industry news you'll ever need. In New York, our transport editor, Tristan McAllister.
Whether it's a closer look at the global aviation heavyweights or embedding with the people who keep Alaska State Ferry System afloat, we take you to the people and the places that make our world move.
Take to the skies, the rails, the seas or the roads with Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me are Samira Shackle and Alessio Patilano. We will look now at Yemen, which is increasingly making the war in Syria look like a model of transparency and comprehensibility. We do know that for the last few weeks, Saudi Arabia has been leading a debatably consequential campaign of airstrikes against the Houthi rebels who have seized control of ever greater swaths of the country. Last night, reports out of Aden, the port which has recently seen the worst of the fighting, suggested that around 100 Saudi Special Forces troops had been seen in the vicinity. Riyadh swiftly denied all such reports. Alessio, what do we believe here? It is fairly common for governments of all stripes to deny that their special forces are doing anything at all, or in some cases even exist. But does it seem likely that the Saudis would have sent soldiers into this?
Well, the way it has been denied, it would suggest certainly that there's a distinction to make between regular forces and special forces, and they denied about the fact that they sent sort of boots on the ground, as it were, but certainly sort of refused to comment about the special forces bits, which would suggest that there are indeed some Saudi forces there, and why not? This is one of the places where the tension between the two factions, it's a hotbed of the current fights. It symbolizes in a way, in many respects, what the Saudi are doing, what the Saudi are supporting in that sense. So and Aden is also strategically quite important because it is positioned strategically in the Gulf. It provides access to ship that are going to support Yemeni fighting. So it seems to me that there is a sense, there is certainly a reason for the Saudi to send special forces, which would be low profile, particularly affecting in conducting targeting and helping the locals actually to keep the fight on.
The backdrop to this, or at least a backdrop to what is a just horrifically complicated scenario, Yemen has become one of those stories that actually makes less sense the more you read about it. But there was the recent discussion, of course, at the Arab League summit in Sharm el-Sheikh about the establishment of a unified Arab military force. Samira, Yemen, of all scenarios, shouldn't it be kind of a test case for such a thing? Is this the sort of situation that a unified Arab military force should be for?
Well, I think we've increasingly seen this idea of a unified Arab force. I think we've increasingly seen over the last few years since the 2011 uprisings this a sort of greater tendency towards Arab countries working together for defence in the region, which is an interesting it's a sort of interesting trend, and I think probably quite a good trend. But Yemen, it's difficult to say. I mean, I suppose it depends what would make it a good case for a good sort of test case for this unified force, because on the one hand, I guess there's the big possibility of contagion to other countries, particularly I think Saudi Arabia sharing a massive border with Yemen is worried about that. But on the other hand, it is very complicated. As you say, it's tribal, it's sectarian, and there is, I think, the risk of countries which have any sort of similar issues getting involved and triggering off those simmering issues in their own countries. So it's a question mark, as it always is with any kind of military embroilment, I guess. But certainly Saudi Arabia, since the airstrikes began about a month ago, I think it was, they've been repeatedly sort of heavily hinting at the possibility of ground troops going into Yemen. They've been sort of vague about it, but talking about it a lot. So I think in this instance, they've said that all the soldiers deployed are Yemeni nationals, which is quite an interesting choice of words. I thought, because that could mean anything, but they could be, you know, they could be Saudi trained Yemeni nationals or whatever. But it's certainly something that's heavily on their mind, even if they haven't actually sent soldiers in this case.
Alessio, final brief thought on this story. Samira used, I think, the very good word embroilment. Have the Saudis possibly reached the point, which is a very dangerous one in any sort of intervention, at which they feel like they have to double down on what they've done? Because the Houthis now control more of the country than they did when the Saudis started bombing. Mm. And have the Saudis got themselves into a position where they can't walk out because they'll look ridiculous? Is it possible they could end up increasing their commitment because they feel like they don't have any other ideas or any other options?
That certainly is a possibility. I think what we're looking at, when we look at Yemen, we're looking at Eastern Ukraine, we're looking at all this crisis, there is a comeback in the fashion of hybrid warfare, a style of warfare that is conducted by forces that are either sort of, they belong to the specializing, sort of like a highly trained, few selected, which limited the number of actually men you have to put on the ground, or people that actually are in that sort of, they are coming from a particular sort of country, but they are deployed on the ground to help the locals to man their fight. I think that that still is an option for Saudi Arabia, and they will try with that one for as long as they can before actually having to scale up, unless they want to look really bad, as you suggested.
Well, finally, and very briskly tonight, we should look at the works of the Norwegian Polar Institute. They've been researching the Arctic, which seems a reasonable thing for an organisation of that name to be doing. Their research vessel, the Lance, has been drifting with pack ice roughly 500 miles from the North Pole. The TLDR version of their findings could be that while it's cold up there, it is less so than it once was. Samira, the ice might disappear entirely during the summer months, they're saying. This opens up new strategic routes, new mineral possibilities. Very briefly, is there any reason at all to be optimistic about this, or is this just going to be the mother of all in diplomatic things?
It's a good question. I mean, I think the sort of existing policy of that region being quite politically neutral, so that it's a sort of space of science, I'm not sure if that would continue. If it's a case of like oil and gas fields and shipping routes, I don't think past example shows that people are very willing to work together on that.
Alessio, how messy is this going to get?
Oh, very much. I mean, this is the next frontier. This is where a lot of nasty thing might actually happen. The Norwegians, they're quite interesting. They're looking very closely. They're paying attention to what the Chinese are doing. They're paying attention to what the Russians are doing. They're paying attention to all the sort of countries that received the status as observatory parties to the Arctic, precisely because they know that once the new routes are open, one's access to resources is going to be there. From a geopolitical and geostrategic point of view, all sorts of discussion about nuclear deterrence, about access to resources, about management of shipping and trade will be there, up there on the table again, open for discussion and for the new rising powers to sort of carry their weight into this situation. So I think this is something that will in the future come ever so more frequently on the spot.
Just looking at that though, and I guess a final thought on this, if you look at the members of the Arctic Council, the countries that are going to be most involved in this, there's some fairly serious rivalries around that table, most notably Russia and the United States. The United States membership, obviously via its possession of Alaska. Yep. Is there any way at all, any likelihood at all of people just deciding, why don't we try and actually work cooperatively on this, as countries did about Antarctica?
True. With one difference. This is the one issue that divides even Canada and the United States, which I really don't think would fall into the category of having strong animosities towards each other. So I'm not confident that countries that already have animosities for all sorts of other reasons will manage to find their way out. There is a lot at stake there. The future of sort of wealthy and powerful countries. Now, that kind of issues never really lend themselves to cooperative forms of interactions.
Okay, on that thought, we will have to leave it there. Alessio Patilano and Samira Shackle, thank you very much for joining us. That's all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. It was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Sara Manetta. Our studio manager was Sean Malervi. For the next half hour, Daniel Giacopelli will keep you company with Monocle's international playlist. At 1900 hours, it's Robert Bound with Culture. At 2200, The Monocle Daily, tonight with Georgina Godwin and Dom Reynolds. This show returns 1800 tomorrow at London time, but for this edition it's goodbye and thanks for listening.